We've got quite a collection of expertise sat at this table here. So I'm going to introduce quickly, in the middle, who'll speak first, Charlotte Dewar, who's head of complaints at the Press Complaints Commission. Now, Charlotte joined the PCC in 2010 as a complaints officer. She was appointed head of complaints and pre-publication services in January this year, so she's just bedded into that job. And she oversees the PCC's complaints handling, anti-harassment, and the pre-publication advisory work. Now, nearest to me is Dr. Fleur Fisher, who's a member of the British Computer Society's Information Privacy Expert Panel and the University of Westminster's Research Ethics Committee, but she's chaired the Teenage Magazine Arbitration Panel since its inception and is a past president of the Medical Women's Federation and in 2008 completed 12 years as vice chair of the International HIV AIDS Alliance. So quite a collection of subject matters. Just And at the far side we have Sue Steele, who's the coordinator of the Anti-Bullying Alliance. And based at the National Children's Bureau, the Anti-Bullying Alliance is a national coalition of over 150 organisations committed to tackling bullying in schools and the wider community. And she's previously worked at both national and local level in a range of posts in education and in health promotion. So I'm just going to ask Charlotte to start and talk for about 5 or 6 minutes, the others the same, and then we'll go into a Q&A. Thank you.
Hello. Well, I feel like I could probably get through about 5 or 6 minutes of conversation just picking up on the points that that Mike and Elizabeth in particular have raised. But I won't do that. Obviously, if there are points that you want to direct to me during the Q&A, I'll be happy to discuss those issues. But I thought it would be useful to give you a little bit of background. I'm sure that I know that some of you are very familiar with the Press Complaints Commission and its work, but others of you may not be. So just to give the very brief background, it is a self-regulatory body. It's not a statutory body. It's funded by a levy on sort of the printed press and, of course, their websites. It includes most of the major national newspaper groups and, of course, lots of regional and local newspapers as well. As, again, many of you will be aware, the PCC is currently undergoing a sort of transition process. Lord Justice Leveson is considering the regulation of the press among the many questions he's considering, and there will be a new body, the shape of which is to be confirmed, probably, you know, within the next kind of, I would guess, 18 months to 2 years, but I'm not the expert on the timing. So that's kind of the background. As David said, I'm the head of complaints and pre-publication services. So I know a lot of people in this room are interested in improving sort of how to create positive coverage of youth and children in the media, and that is a really, really important issue. Because of the nature of what I do, unfortunately, in some ways, I usually hear about when things have gone wrong or where people are concerned that things might go wrong or could go wrong. So just to briefly cover, I'll just briefly talk about the editor's code of practice and how it relates to children. Basically, the two most relevant parts are Clause 6, children, and Clause 7, children in sex cases. I think you all should have a copy of the editor's code with you so you can kind of check this out in detail after. But basically, the kind of the parts of Clause 6 that we deal with most frequently is a kind of an umbrella protection that children should be free of unnecessary intrusion during their time at school, and that's just sort of a broad protection. And then the sort of the second part that we hear a lot about is specific protections on sort of interactions between journalists and children. So that's photographing them, and that also incorporates the use of photographs of them and interviewing them. And basically, it's not a blanket prohibition on publishing pictures and talking to kids, but it is it requires consent where it's going to be an issue that relates to the child's welfare. So that's really when things sort of toughen up and become much more strict from the PCC point of view, is where there's actually going to be an effect on the child. And obviously, deciding whether or not it's an issue that relates to the child's welfare is often a kind of a difficult area. As I mentioned, Clause 7, I mean, this is obviously an area that fortunately covers many, many fewer children, children who are victims or witnesses of sex crimes, but of course they deserve, as incredibly vulnerable individuals, very strong protections and we work very hard to ensure that there's kind of a strong response when there is sort of usually the issues that we deal with. It's virtually always a kind of very unintentional sort of a little bit of information that allowed someone to put two and two together. Often court reporting is a very difficult area, sort of keeping detail out of stories so that even in small communities, these children cannot be identified. And then finally, hope I'm doing all right on time, just a couple of sort of issues that are kind of in transition of major interest to us at the moment. Social media is creating for us, as well as for everyone else, lots of new problems and new issues in terms of how you respond to the amount of information about children that's in the public domain, kind of how newspapers can responsibly interact with that. And as Mike was pointing out, the Dunblane survivor story was a sort of massive sort of turning point, I think, for everyone really waking up to this issue. It was the Sunday Express, and they published lots of pictures of these kids kind of doing very normal teenager-y type things that kind of, if it hadn't been presented in this context as, you know, how dare you enjoy life as a Dunblane survivor, you know, probably wouldn't have had a major, you know, could, you know, it wasn't images of kind of antisocial or criminal behavior. It was sort of normal life, and they hadn't been behind privacy settings. So in some sense, I think it was, oh, it's in the public domain, but the commission did uphold the complaint kind of with very strong words of criticism, saying that just because something is not behind a privacy settings does not mean that it's fair game. And we now spend a lot of time giving pre-publication advice to publications about how to deal responsibly with that kind of material. And that, just as a kind of final thought, that also transitions into sort of writing stories about antisocial and criminal behavior. Most journalists are quite familiar with the laws around reporting juvenile kind of criminal justice, but because social media and the kind of the much greater ability of people to kind of broadcast material from mobile phone footage and otherwise, sort of pictures of kids doing things in public that are wrong, how the media can cover that responsibly and what kind of protections kids who are engaging in antisocial acts should be given is a really difficult and interesting area. So anyway, I'll be happy to answer any more questions, but that's it for now.
My name's Fleur Fisher. I'm a doctor by background. I've had a bit of a ragbag career, really, and general practice for about 5 years, and then I was, for years and years, I did family planning, sexual health, and child development clinics. Well, I had three kids, a granny, a dog, and a test pilot husband, and couldn't manage to get any kind of more prestigious job. Then as general manager in the NHS, when I was accountable for child protection for 6 years, in our health authority, and then I went to work for the BMA. And it was, that leads into now about TMAP, how TMAP started. It's really strange how these things do begin, isn't it? In 1977, a completely, well, not one of the most well-known and distinguished MPs, Peter Lough, Conservative, bought a teenage magazine for his 11-year-old girl to go on holiday. And he was really absolutely shocked by the explicit sexual content. And there's some completely bizarre debates in the House of Commons, and I think it was even mentioned in the Lords. Lots of upheaval about how frightful all of this was. And as a result of that, there was a demand in Parliament that the teenage magazines be age stamped, so that a poor little corner shop who was selling these mags would have to demand proof of age before they sold them. A completely unmanageable scenario. So the PPA, then called the Periodical Publishers Association, they've now just renamed it the Professional Publishers Association. Very clever, you don't have to get a new logo. But the PPA, who represented the magazine sector, actually worked with the Family Planning Association, Brook Advisory, people who worked with youngsters. They commissioned Kay Wellings, a very distinguished researcher in sexual health, to look at the issues of evidence about the impact of teenage magazines on young people. And the Home Office was involved. And they had a final meeting. I'd never heard about any of it, but they had a final meeting in the BMA. And as I was then head of Ethics, Science and Information at the BMA, they asked me to chair it. At the end of that, it was agreed that it should a teenage independent self-regulatory body called the Teenage Magazine Arbitration Panel, TMAP, should be set up, which would arbitrate on complaints against an agreed code, which was agreed at that meeting. I didn't just put the code in your pack. I put one of our recent reports because I thought it might let you see the kind of things we do and the codes on the back, back page there. And I was then asked to chair this panel. I think my colleagues at the BMA, I was then retiring, so I am really quite old, thought this was a very amusing little job for me to be getting on with. But it's been, apart from other things I've done, it's been very involving and surprising. I just looked at the old reports, I was absolutely amazed. In the first year, when I looked at it, there were an awful lot more teenage mags. The sector's dying, really, now. There were lots and lots more magazines then. And we had 85 complaints, I think. I haven't had any complaints now for at least 3 years. I don't know how we keep going, but there you are. We're still self-regulatory. I say nothing. But we had 85 complaints the first year. 50 of them were actually all identically worded. Quite a lot were written in green ink on multiple sheets of paper. But we adjudicated on everyone. It's not like, oh, well, we don't think that's a very nice picture with boys holding tomato ketchup bottles in front of their genitals. We think that's rude. It wasn't that. That was one of the complaints. We actually look at the complaints against the code. And then we're very clear about which bits of the code are not complied with or are complied with. Sometimes we do get, I mean, it's all much small beer compared with all the big stuff all of you do, but we do sometimes get magazine editors ringing up and saying, hey, how about we do this? And occasionally we think, well, really, I think that wouldn't be terribly wise. But there is one thing that has been worrying in all of this, is that I think there has been an increasing carefulness about the topics that are actually dealt with. What we do, the panel, we do take it seriously, and we do meet 3 or 4 times a year, and we do have all the magazines. And then each of us takes one to look at, and we look at and see what kind of topics are dealt with and how they're dealt with, and if there's anything, even if there isn't a complaint, but we think this isn't really awfully good or awfully accurate, we reflect it back. I also do try, though they're sometimes a bit slow, to get annually the qualifications of the people who are answering the problem pages, or at least the people overseeing the alleged things that Take That Boys are saying about people's problems or whatever, so we actually know that there are professionally qualified people behind. The interesting thing about all of this is that it's actually, I come from a background, I was once asked why on earth I was invited to something. I didn't know really, actually. Why they'd invite me is the Welcome had asked me to be on a committee looking at access, unconsented access to people's health data, right? And they said, what are you? And I suddenly found I was saying, I'm a privacy campaigner. I was quite surprised. But actually, that is what I am. And I'm like that for the young people as well. I actually believe passionately that people's identifiable health information, which I've called the virtual naked patient, and I suppose our identifiable information makes us a virtual naked citizen, really. But certainly health information should not be accessed without the person's consent. And that goes for the young person as well. So because of that, although we're actually there as a self-regulatory body, we have been a body that's been able to link with others who are concerned about things which are actually threats to young people's privacy. I mentioned one thing, for instance, it's about 7 years ago, I think, Beverly Hughes, in the last government, the governments are all equally awful. I mean, it doesn't matter which it is, they're all awful, aren't they? And we've now got this whole thing, which is going to be like the Stasi. If someone said 1984 was not meant to be a kind of a blueprint, it was actually meant to be a warning, that this idea now that everybody's emails and the websites they visit shall actually all be gathered up and kept for, wait for it, folks, for 15 years by the ISPs. However, one of the things that we did actually work together, and it's an example of some of the things we can do, the Teenage Mags, and we linked with other organisations, was when there was a suggestion Well, it was going to be in legislation, but it would be incumbent in the regulation following the Sexual Offences Act 2003, which in itself was a bit of a disaster, that anybody professional who was aware of a young person under 18, which is the definition of a child, who was, they thought, might be having a sexual relationship, should actually report that to the police. The police were horrified. The Department of Health were absolutely enraged. I think this was the Department for Education, Beverly Hughes, and that took a seven-month kind of long campaign. We did quickly a joint letter between teaching organisations, social services, medical organisations, put that through. We had meetings in the House of Lords under Baroness Gould, lots of things. I remember it took 7 months to actually get that, which would have completely blown, put a grenade in young people's privacy. Actually, it was agreed that that should not go forward. The Department of Health, of course, was horrified. One thing that young people really want in their personal and sexual health attendance is they actually want privacy. They do want privacy, confidentiality. They don't want their information to be shared without their consent. And it has been interesting that over the years, every couple of years, I managed to have a forum where for half a day we get outside, people come to speak about issues which concern the, and we get magazine editors, publishers, the problem page people, and a range of other people come, often with a minister, even, or an MP. So the TMAP doesn't actually have many. I mean, I don't know why we still exist, honestly. I have to tell you, in the beginning, I had to make an annual report to the head of the Obscene Publications Unit in the Home Office. Every year I had to go and see the head of the Obscene Publications Unit. We became quite good friends. She had a teenage daughter. We got to know each other quite well. Now nobody wants to own us, but we still exist. We still regulate, so if you are complaining, you can do so through Parent Port, which nobody accesses at all, I think, but still. Do you know anybody who accesses Parent Port? No, I don't. But we're linked to there. So if there are complaints, we're still there. But in a way, we still have, as well as that regulatory function, a function where we can act together to protect young people in situations where society and the government seems to take what's right for them and their rights rather lightly.
The Anti-Bullying Alliance is celebrating its 10th anniversary this year in 2012. We were set up by the National Children's Bureau and NSPCC in 2002 when it was recognised, and I've been thinking about the anniversary, I'm still a bit sort of shocked really that it's really only 10 years since it was really recognised that that bullying was a serious issue for young people that wasn't being taken seriously enough by national or local government or in schools or in society more widely. We do a number of things. As David said, we are an alliance of organisations, but we have a small sort of central team that coordinates things. And we do things like encouraging research and the dissemination of research on bullying, the causes and particularly how it can be tackled. We provide a gateway for resources and support for schools particularly and other practitioners working in this area. But we also have, we're also a campaigning organisation. And over those 10 years, there's no doubt that the media has actually played a vital role in moving the issue of bullying from something that at best was seen as an inevitable part of children growing up to at worst seen as character building. I mean, you know, those sort of ideas were still around 10 years ago, and I don't think they're around very much today. We now understand that it's a serious blight on the lives of many children. It's not acceptable, and it's the responsibility of all of us, professionally and as parents and personally, to tackle. But the media presentation of bullying does pose a particular challenge for us. you know, in terms of the kinds of things that we've been discussing this morning, there's no getting away from the fact that bullying is an unacceptable behaviour that is being perpetrated by children and young people. And it's an inherently negative message. And it does lead to alarmist and sometimes lurid and, in our view, unhelpful headlines. But, you know, even in our campaigning role for the Anti-Bullying Alliance, our job is not simply to raise the issue and leave children and parents frightened that something terrible is going to happen to them, or to leave schools feeling they're being scapegoated yet again for, you know, another of society's problems. And particularly through our annual Anti-Bullying Week every November, we try to engage and work with the media to highlight the serious effects and consequences of bullying, but at the same time try to focus the agenda in a way that supports positive action rather than the sort of despair and demonisation that we can see in the press around a lot of issues. I thought it just might be helpful just to sort of talk through a few of the sort of ways we do that, the kinds of policies that we have in place about the way we work with the media. I don't think it's rocket science, and I don't think it's anything that anyone, any other organisation probably couldn't do or largely are doing. But as was said earlier by Elizabeth, we try to work positively with the media whilst adhering to some basic principles to try and, as far as we can, get some balance into the information and its presentation. Ultimately, we have a free press, and that's, we wouldn't want anything different, would we? The press has, the media has to do what it does. But there are ways in which I think you can work more positively with the media to try and get better images of young people. So first of all, when there are, you know, there are a lot of victim stories about bullying. The Anti-Bullying Alliance doesn't promote those, and we refuse to be drawn into commenting on the detail of specific incidents. We will, if we're asked for a comment, try to draw the reporting to something that is about how this issue can be dealt with, rather than necessarily the awfulness, and it is awful in many cases, of the actual incidents that are being reported. We discourage the use of the term bully or bullies in anything, in any, we would never use it in our own press releases, and we would never use it when we were talking to journalists. It's quite awkward to talk about children who were bullied, but we believe it's really important to recognise that bullying is one aspect of the behaviour of some children and young people. It shouldn't define their whole being. They're not just a bully. And using those kinds of words doesn't help us to understand how we should respond. As far as we can, we facilitate the voices of young people who've dealt with bullying, how they've overcome the problems, as well as the negative effects of the difficulties they face. We cooperate with the media in providing case studies and vignettes and carefully managed access to children and young people who've done positive work in their schools and communities to tackle bullying. And there are many hundreds, if not thousands of them, who are actually working, doing fantastic work, and that needs to come through as well. We offer statistics and a professional view to support journalists ground their stories in an evidence base. And we will also provide information about where children and parents can get help and advice, links to websites and helplines, so that, you know, at the end of an article, there is something positive that people can actually do. As was mentioned earlier, we find the regional and local press and the online media generally offer more opportunity to give a more nuanced view of the issues. They've got more space, they need more stories and so on. On the whole, we've done well in terms of the sort of media coverage that we get, particularly during Anti-Bullying Week. You know, I can think back to the last Anti-Bullying Week where, you know, we got articles that really, if you were a parent reading it, you would start out thinking, yes, there is a problem here, I need to be aware of it, this is something I need to talk about with my child, here's what the school could be doing, here's what I could be doing, here's where I can go for information if I need. And that, you know, that can only be helpful. We do our best to sort of support and facilitate that. It doesn't always work. You know, we still get the headlines and the articles that aren't as we would have wanted them to be. But overall, we think the media has been helpful in raising this issue and continuing it to keep it on the agenda, but also moving it forward, recognising that things do change. Thank you.